If I can have your attention, we'll go ahead and get started with our program for this morning so that we can maximize the amount of time available to our speaker. I want to welcome all of you to another meeting of the First Friday Breakfast Club, an association of gay and bisexual men and trans men, and the largest private breakfast club in the state of Iowa. It's our tradition to provide an opportunity for those who are here for the first time to introduce themselves or have their host introduce them. Not a requirement, but if there are those who are here for the first time, this would be your opportunity. Anyone? Okay, there are a couple of unfamiliar faces around. I won't call on anyone, but if those of you who are regulars will look around and seek out unfamiliar faces and make sure that they feel welcome and will continue to participate in FFBC, that would be wonderful. We have several announcements. First, the book exchange, which is on the grand piano back here. Thanks to my partner, Scott Cupneo, for coordinating that. Also on the piano are the some copies of the most recent issue of our monthly newsletter. We are in a transition right now with my secretary retiring. We're transitioning to a sort of database filtered thing that I can't even describe because I don't platform, that means something that a political party does or that a railroad train stops at. And so at any rate, we're making this transition. If there are those of you who have been getting the newsletter and didn't get the most recent one, which went out last week, number one, you can get a copy of it on the piano. Number two, touch base with me so that we make sure we get you back on our list. I know of at least two people that got dropped in the mailing that last took place. We'll correct that, and eventually we'll get all the bugs worked out. So those are available. If you did not receive an RSVP reminder of this meeting, it is because I don't have an accurate email address for you. If you'll get that to me, you will start receiving RSVP reminders of our meetings as they occur. I invite you to check out our website. We're constantly trying to update it. And also on the website, you can access audio recordings of our speakers. So if you want to hear a repeat of one of our speakers, or you miss a meeting and want to hear the speaker, you have that opportunity on our website. On the registration desk, there's a sheet to invite you to identify some people who might be candidates for membership in FFBC. Give us the name, and if you have it, contact information, and we will extend a personal invitation to them. Then, a number of announcements. The number one announcement is our scholarship donor recognition reception that is going to take place this evening from 6:30 until 9 o'clock. It's going to be at Scott's and my home, 2924 Druid Hill Drive, and all are welcome. We're going to have food and drink and a good time, and it is becoming a tradition. And so I hope to see, well, how about this? Let's see a show of hands of those who are at this point, anyway, planning to attend this evening. Okay, all right, well, that gives us a good idea. Thank you very much. Good, we'll see you then this evening around 6:30 or after. Next, I want to call to your attention our caucuses that are scheduled for next Monday, 7 o'clock. And each precinct has its own caucus location, so please check that out, and I encourage you to participate in the caucuses. One way or another, you're participating in politics, whether you go and do something or sit on your hands. I encourage you to go and do something, and caucuses are one place where you can do that. And coincidentally, we have a candidate for the House of Representatives who wants to unseat Mr. Young, which is a virtuous endeavor, Austin Frerichs. Austin, would you stand up and...
Hey, everybody. Caucuses are especially important this year.
They are especially important. We have crowded fields, Austin is smarter than the average bear and highly experienced and an economist and would do well in Washington, D.C. on our behalf. Thanks for running. Next, I want to call on Dan Jensen, who's going to say a couple of things about a Pride handout that is on your tables.
Sorry for bombarding you guys with a lot of information. There's three pieces of information that are regarding the Pride Gala. So the Pride Gala is Friday, February 23rd at the performing, the Temple for Performing Arts. We're pretty excited about it. We have a great speaker, John Alha. He's a known psychologist for preteen and teens transgender children. He does a great job. He did a National Geographic special with Katie Couric last year that aired on TV. He's pretty awesome. For those of you who do not want to sign up for a ticket online, I've provided just something you can fill out right now and write a check. If you do it online, there is a fee, processing fee, so this would exclude the processing fee. I've also included the nominations for awards. So we've tried to include individuals, allies, and companies. So we hope that we get lots of nominations. We have about 25 right now. There's 8 awards, we have about 25 nominations, but we would like to get many more. So please don't be shy about that. I also included our speaker series overview. The speaker series, with the exception of Jean Malpa, will be at the Art Center. They're free of charge, with the exception of the gala speaker. So please come and attend that. And then finally, we have our book club meeting. The book is Middlesex. It's February 15th. It will be at Smoky Row, and Middlesex is by Jeffrey, I think he's pronounced something like Eugenides, or it's, that's my best guess.
Okay.
Right, thank you.
Okay, next, Tim Schreck is the chair of our scholarship committee, Tim is right here. There you go. Tim is inviting any of you who might be interested in serving on the scholarship committee to contact me or him. If you contact me, I will get your contact information to Tim. If there are those of you who would be interested in serving in the on the scholarship committee, you would be encouraged and welcome. Next, our FFBC board is going to be meeting next Wednesday, the 7th, at 6:15 at our home. If there are those of you who are members who would like to attend, you're certainly welcome, and that's next Wednesday. Our newsletter copy deadline is Monday, a week from next, so that would be the 12th of February. If you have something on your mind, it's probably something that would be of interest to others. And so we would encourage you to write it down and get it to me, and we'll try and get it into the newsletter and share that with others in our group. Then also at your tables is the convenience of a roster of upcoming events that are planned by Prime Timers of Central Iowa. Yet this month alone, there are a dozen social events of various kinds that may be of interest to you. So if you are interested in another outlet where you can interact with other like-minded, enlightened people, that would be an opportunity for you. And you can also go to their Facebook page. And on that Facebook page, you can get all of this same information about times, dates, locations, and the like. Something for you to save the date, March the 24th is going to be the Queer Community Summit at the Botanical Center from 8 till 5 in the afternoon. The registration fee is $10. If you have any questions about that, touch base with Rick Miller. He's involved in organizing it. And there's Rick. Perfect. Okay, and then with that, we will turn to John Schmaker, who is going to introduce our speaker for this morning. John.
Good morning, everybody, and happy Groundhog's Day. If that were a national holiday, we'd all be home asleep right now. We have an old tradition here at the First Friday Breakfast Club, and that tradition goes back to Dennis Ryerson, who spoke at one of our first meetings back in the last century. And that tradition is to welcome the executive directors, executive editors of the Des Moines Register as our breakfast speakers. That has also included Carolyn Washburn in 2006. The Gannett Corporation obliges us by supplying a steady stream of outstanding leaders. Today we are pleased to add another chapter in this tradition by welcoming the Des Moines Register's executive editor, Carol Hunter. Carol earned her degree in journalism from the University of Kansas in 1979. Her career in the news business has included newspapers in Santa Fe, New Mexico, Bridgewater, New Jersey, and Green Bay, Wisconsin, before arriving in 2004 at the surprising place, Des Moines. At the Des Moines Register, Carol has served as opinion editor, political editor, and as news director, and she is also regional editor for the USA Today Network. Over the years, Carol has adapted to huge changes as the newspaper business shifts from paper and trucks to bits and bytes. Faithful readers such as myself have watched, sometimes nervously, as the Register moves through this transition. Today's newspaper business requires some really smart people to run it. When in the court of public opinion, we must do battle against the forces that don't much like us and would do us harm, and when right-wing politicians argue about bathrooms and others lie about us publicly, what matters is having a vehicle for the truth. There is no important ally than the folks who own the printing press. Let us continue that relationship this morning by welcoming Carol Hunter.
What a gracious introduction. Thank you so much. I'll add a little bit more about my background. I grew up in Kansas on a farm. We ran a dairy, grew corn and soybeans. That will sound familiar to Iowans, and also wheat and milo in Kansas. Went to the country church about a mile away, and we were 4-H kids. I just mention that because I think it does help me kind of understand the underpinnings of Iowa's agricultural economy. And I run into so many people who are working perhaps in the, you know, the downtown financial towers here in Des Moines, but they grew up on a farm or grew up in rural Iowa. So I think it helps me kind of understand that ethos as well. My first priority this morning is going to be to disabuse you of the notion that I work in a dying industry. I hear that a lot. People come up and say, oh, I'm so sorry, it must be difficult. And certainly many days it is. But we remain a very robust industry. I work with great people. I see a couple of my colleagues here in the audience today. And as the introduction stated, we have deep beliefs and a deep commitment to the abiding necessity of strong journalism. We are, though, certainly an industry that's in transformation. While the Register still publishes a print newspaper, we also publish a desk website, a mobile website. We have specialty sites like RagBri and Hawk Central. We have apps like Cyclone Insider. More than half our audience these days comes to us on a mobile device. So as a publisher and editor, you're thinking about how to prepare and design news that maybe appear on platforms from your print newspaper to a tiny screen, and how best to deliver that news. I'm going to walk through some slides first that kind of give some background on that disruption in our industry, kind of just to show you the reality of what we're up against. And then discuss more specifically the Register, what we're doing to sort of thrive still in a very disruptive industry. Okay, we'll see how we go. Wrong device. Come on. It worked so well. And if all else fails, I'll
close it. It'll be open. It was changing on there.
Thank you very much. Sorry for that brief interruption. What I've done is put together a little bit of research here from the Pew Research Center. This will be, most of it is national information. Not able to obviously divulge some of the proprietary information about the register. But print circulation really has been in decline for some time. I mean, there's been many earlier disruptions to print, from radio to television to cable to on and on. What I'm showing is kind of the high water mark in a lot of these slides, and then 2016, the latest full year of information. And the high water mark of daily print circulation nationwide was in way back in 1984, and in those 32 years, a drop of 45%. Sunday circulation held on longer. The high water mark nationally was 1993 and a drop of 40% since then. Sunday does remain across the nation the most robust product as far as advertising and penetration, and that's certainly true of the register as well. But print is far from dead, and the register in particular, compared to publications across the country, remains a print powerhouse. Now I will say, using readership numbers here to be fully transparent, which is larger than a circulation number. Readership counts like the four people in a household which may be reading a paper, or the pass-along readership when your neighbor reads it too. Still doing fairly well among younger people, 25 to 54, good household incomes, good education. But as a business person, these are the kind of numbers that would perhaps make you nauseated. 2005 was the high watermark for advertising revenue. And this is for newspaper organizations, and this number even includes the digital revenue that news organizations are taking in as well. Just a dramatic drop even in that 11 years in ad revenue. You have that kind of dramatic drop, well, you've got to cut costs too. And that's what has happened to newsroom staffing. 40% nationally, and that is certainly reflected in the register numbers. Even a little bit worse, I was in a presentation in the past year with one of the top news executives in our company, which owns 109 local newspapers, and said that on average, most newsrooms are about half the size they were a decade ago. Having been at the register 13 years, I can attest that we're roughly in that ballpark. But then you take a step back and look at the bigger picture, and the Register maintains the largest newsroom in Iowa by far. If, as a businessman, looking at those figures, you would go, well, heck, if you've had this kind of disruption, what have you done to transform yourself? And we've done a lot. transforming into the digital age. This shows, again, the high, this is just kind of a beginning number. Back in 2011, nationally, revenue from digital for newspaper legacy companies was 17%. As of 2016, 29%. Below that is unique visitors to the top 50 newspaper websites, and the Register is among the top 50. And in just 3 years, showing an increase of 43%. 2017 would be that much larger. So here's a little bit more of Des Moines specific data. This is from ComScore, which is a common measure of media reach and penetration. And the Register leads in this market, both in unique visitors and page views. That's a November score. That's the latest available. And frankly, ComScore goes up and down a little. Sometimes the KCCI will be ahead of us on a few of those measures. We happen to look pretty good this month, so I'm glad. Maybe I'm glad December hadn't come in yet. Register was leading in two measures, but that's we almost always lead in the unique visitors, have just taken over some months on page views. KCCI tends to lead in visits, and a lot of that, frankly, is because of the weather. People go on their devices all the time, just morning, night, when they're going to go outside and check the weather. And you also see that in page views in the sense that they're going to KCCI, you know, they click in once to check on something like that and then they go away. We have a lot more page views per visit. Our site is much more rich, a lot more content, so when people come to our sites, they'll stick around and check out a few stories. I was seeing Brian Smith here in the audience. He could give you all these numbers, like 18 ways to Sunday. And he's much more the digital expert than I am. So Brian can chip in if there's something that I'm omitting. So given those numbers, you see the decline in print advertising. It becomes so important for us to grow digital audience. I mean, this has really become our mantra. This is a way where we are competing well against those other media. So we've gotten somewhat obsessive about our digital numbers. We measure them all sorts of ways. Visitors to our content, page views, video engagement, views per visit, return visits in 3 days. This really is Brian's life. He looks at this kind of stuff all the time. One thing that everyone on the staff has at their desktop is a program called Chartbeat. And it can tell you, this was taken about 10 o'clock last night, and it shows you that there were 673 people accessing our content at 10 o'clock at night. It can tell you that how many people were on the homepage. 74 people were reading a story about millennials who are opening businesses in the little town of New Providence. That's going to be in our front page on Sunday, but we tend to post early so people online can get a look at it. And then on down, showing what everyone is reading. Off on the left side here, it tells us how many are new visitors to the site, how many are returning visitors. It can tell us that almost everyone reading at 10 o'clock last night was from the United States, as far as their ISP addresses. A few people from Canadians, and we have one reader from Brazil. Over on the right, it tells us where traffic is coming from, whether it's kind of internal within the site, social sites referring lots to us, and then it goes into the social sites, lots from search, Google search being the primary search engine, Facebook, of course, which I mean social refer, and then down on the right, we even have a list of some of the tweets that are driving traffic to our site. If you can click into further on this and look up an individual story, and Brian Taylor Carlson, our dining writer, can attest to this. It can be somewhat sobering because it will show you like a line where most people are cutting away from your story, which can be a little deflating as a writer at times. So growing audience is very important to us, but one thing that has been very gratifying to me as we learn more about our audience every day is that traditional journalism still works and still attracts audience. Yes, there are a lot of people, if we put up cat videos all the time, who would be attracted to that. And we're certainly not above putting up pictures and video of the cute new little lions at the Blank Park Zoo on our site. Even newspapers, as you'll recall, have comics pages and have different things just for fun. And certainly there's part of our websites and our offerings are devoted to things like that. But time and time again, what I consider our very most important work, things like investigative journalism, do draw large audiences as well. And so investigative reporting is one thing that we remain very committed to at the Register. It's one of my highest priorities. I think it is our purpose as part of the Fourth Estate to hold government and powerful institutions accountable. I'm going to run through just a few of what I consider our most important work in recent months. And one of a series of ongoing stories has been about the consequences of privatizing Medicaid. In this slide is, I'm going to forget his name right quick, Jamie Campbell of Fontenelle. He was paralyzed from the neck down when he was a high school wrestler, but he's an incredibly accomplished individual. He serves on the local school board. He lives on his own. You know, he works. He has a full life. But that's in part through the assistance provided by Medicaid. He's had for years now about 5 hours of home assistance that has helped him be able to live independently. Well, after privatization of Medicaid, the company came back and said, no, you're only allowed to have 2 hours. This is one of those kind of things that just makes no sense, because with less help, it risks him having to go to a nursing facility to live, which would, of course, cost the state so much more money. Well, he did appeal the company's decision, and thankfully, he did win the appeal later. But what we've done is we have continued to report, and we've found this pattern of cases where people needing home care are being denied by these companies. And so Jason Clayworth, one of our reporters, had another big package on that a couple of weeks ago. And it has come to the attention of the governor's office. Governor Reynolds has said that, and Director Jerry Foxhoven, that they will investigate this particular type of denial because they're seeing it again and again. This slide, of course, shows Nicole Finn. This was the day of her sentencing. Three life sentences for starving three of her children, and of course one, Natalie Finn, who was 16 years old, died. Lee Rood started reporting on this case from the time that Nicole Finn was arrested through her sentencing. And Lee was the first person reporter who dug out information and found out that neighbors had reported Nicole Finn to DHS months ahead of her death. School officials had also reported suspicions to the DHS that Natalie Finn may not have been cared for. Police were also involved. All of that had been brought to the attention of government authorities, yet no intervention was done, at least not enough intervention to save Natalie's life. So I think that's been one of our most important investigations in the past year. And we've had legislative committees and also internal DHS investigations of staffing levels and also just policies to try to prevent and things like this and protect Iowa's children. Investigative reporter Kathy Bolton wrote a series of stories under the label of Iowa's Driving Drunk, Iowa's Deadly Problem, about the toll that drunken driving takes on our state and the fact that laws in Iowa about drunken driving are more lax than those in most states. One of the things she wrote about is that nearly a third of drivers charged with vehicular homicide were repeat drunken drivers. And then she outlined some possible solutions. And there have been some changes in state law starting with last year's legislative session. Roxanne Ryan, who's commissioner of the Department of Public Safety, wrote this to Kathy earlier this year. Quote, it looks like we saw about a 17% decline in traffic fatalities in Iowa in 2017. Other states have not seen similar declines. I want to thank you for the role you have played in saving lives. And then this slide shows a worker at TPI Composites, the wind blade manufacturer in Newton. Those three earlier slides about it were investigations done by that three-person investigative team that we maintain. But we also encourage each of our beat reporters to do investigative reporting as well. And this was a story written by business reporter Kevin Hardy and also Grant Rogers, a course reporter, helped with the story. Six employees at this point have sued TPI Composites, claiming that the chemicals that they used in their work have caused these ongoing skin injuries. So Grant and Kevin really started looking, did an incredible data review. They looked at logs of Iowa's Occupational Safety and Health Administration and found since TPI opened in 2008, more than 300 recorded cases of skin injuries at the plant. Iowa's OSHA has now begun an investigation into these injuries. They have publicly said that it was the Register's investigation that led them to open an official formal investigation. In this slide on the far left is Eric Rose. He's the Chief Operating Officer of the Waukee Community School District. Rose fabricated employee time cards, used school property for personal use, and solicited more than 3,000 in donations for his son's hockey team from district vendors, according to a March 2016 report on an investigation conducted on behalf of the district. That investigative report was never made public until last fall when our suburbs reporter, Kim Norvell, got a tip from a source and started following up, asking questions, and filing Freedom of Information Act requests. She also found out that Waukee Police Department had conducted a criminal investigation, and that investigation had found, quote, probable cause to support an arrest, but the Dallas County attorney declined to prosecute. Her stories, though, have prompted ongoing debate among residents of the community about handling of this matter. The Register is also committed to what I would call public service reporting. And for the past about 5 years now, we've selected a topic each year where we say we're going to take a deep dive and really look at a serious issue that's facing Iowa. About 5 years ago, the first one was called Iowa's Kids, and it was about the risk today, education, health, basically their future that face Iowa kids that perhaps a generation ago they weren't as much at risk. We also did a series on Black Iowa, facing looking at the disparities that Black Iowans continue to face. And this past year we did the series called Changing Iowa, and it was about all sorts of really long-term demographic and economic shifts facing the state. This first story that kicked off the series, this is a slide from Clinton, Iowa, And Clinton is what the census calls a micropolitan area. They're from, Clinton has about 26,000 population. These areas are 10,000 to 50,000 residents. And ISU's done a lot of research on this. The metropolitan areas in Iowa have done quite well in the past decade, Des Moines Metro in particular, Cedar Rapids, the Iowa City corridor. But these micropolitan areas, since the 2008 recession, just have not kept up as well, seeing more job losses as they've gone along. And it's these areas that for their region serve as very important places for education and jobs and healthcare. So if these places are suffering across the state, places like Clinton, Keokuk, Fort Madison, Mason City, that doesn't bode well for all of Iowa. We looked at things like how automation is changing jobs in Iowa, and in some cases, killing jobs. We looked at mid-sized farms, which are really being squeezed out. Of course, we've seen farms get bigger and bigger in Iowa, and we've seen this nice little bubbling up of smaller organic farms, but that 500-acre farm that was owned by a family really faces a tight squeeze. And then we've also looked at aging Iowa, how many small towns across Iowa really just don't have many children anymore. We've turned up so many interesting things that we're kind of continuing this one a little bit into this year. A group of Iowans have organized first time a year ago something called Iowa's Rural Summit. They're holding another one in April, and we're going to continue reporting on these issues up until April. But we have also chosen our one for 2018, and that's going to be about mental health services in Iowa. We got kind of a jump start on that one. Many of you read the story. Mary Neubauer wrote this very powerful obituary when her son Sergey died at age 18, committed suicide. That prompted Kathy Obradovich, who's a friend of Mary, to pledge in a column that she was going to organize a forum and invite every one of the gubernatorial candidates and force them to talk about mental health issues in the state. And with some help with friends at the Register, including Brian, that happened. 12 candidates showed up to talk about mental health. Des Moines University stepped up as a partner, and about 400 people turned out. One of the candidates told me later that this forum already has changed the trajectory of the governor's race in Iowa because it forced all of these people to study up on mental health and learn what the problems are, and so they're now talking about them as they talk with Iowans on the campaign trail. Tony Lays is our main health reporter. He's written about health for about 20 years. He has written a lot about mental health already, and I expect some terrific reporting from him in the coming year. One of the things about being the largest newsroom in the state of Iowa is that it does allow us to have beat specialists. We have a four-person business staff. Kim Norvell covers growth and development, Pat Johnson, retail, Danelle Eller, agriculture and energy, and Kevin Hardy, jobs and the economy. We have a three-person political reporting staff. Jason Noble is our chief politics reporter, and then Breanne Fonensteel and Bill Petrosky cover the State House, and that's just the reporting staff, doesn't count Kathy Obradovich taking opinion. Two people on education, both a K through 12 reporter, Mackenzie Ryan and Kathy Bolton, a higher education reporter. Mentioned Tony Lays, our health reporter. Our dining reporter, we have right here, Brian Taylor Carlson, Matt Linecooler, covering music. Sports, of course, is a main driver of audience. You'll notice here that I very carefully selected a slide that shows a Cyclone and a Hawkeye. I decided I didn't want to provoke a fight this early in the morning. clearly something that drives a lot of audience to our website. I continue, of course, to provide coverage of UNI, Drake, the high schools. One thing, though, we certainly are devoting much more of our attention to digital coverage. That's where high school and college students are. They're looking at their phones for scores, commentary, that sort of thing. So it has caused us to shift our coverage, and that we don't spend nearly as much time, even in print anymore, on actual game coverage. But what we've seen is that coverage of recruiting does very well with our digital audience. I mean, people just like to kind of follow if there's a star athlete at high school, follow if they're being recruited by the colleges. And then just human interest features, because that's something that all of us can be interested in, even if we're not a hardcore sports fan. Commentary remains a very important part of what we do. Editorials, of course. I just pulled out a couple of our Sunday editorial packages recently, print packages. We stand up and say that the state of Iowa needs more revenue. We're not afraid to say the state actually needs to raise taxes. And you may not agree with that at all, but I think it's important to take a strong stand and really just to provoke thought and comment. I don't think that we have to actually change minds every time. That's not my goal. My goal really is just to provoke thought, to provoke conversation about important issues. We have a series of veteran columnists, a handful of veteran columnists. Rekha Basu, of course, she focuses on all sorts of social issues. Kathy Obradovich, I've mentioned before. Kyle Munton is our Iowa columnist. He treks across the state to dig out compelling stories. And then our Metro columnist, Dan Finney. Very proud of our photo staff, a very accomplished staff. Through the years, the Register staff has won 4 Pulitzer Prizes for its photography. Have 6 photographers now, and one of their new pieces of technology they use is that we have 2, actually now 3, licensed drone pilots. And so we were able to fly up a drone above, this was Plaza, Bird's Eye View into Plaza Lanes, the fire there in December. Each of those photographers is an accomplished videographer as well. Several of our photographers have won regional Emmys, you know, competing against television stations. This is a story of Will Cohn, the little guy on the left there, 7 years old. He was the very first patient admitted to the University of Iowa Stead Families Children's Hospital's new building. And this, of course, is a story about the Hawkeye Wave, you know, the new tradition that fans in Kinnick Stadium will turn around after the first quarter and wave up to the children watching the game up at the hospital. And we had done lots of stories about the Hawkeye Wave and had a proposal from a USA Today reporter to come out and do another story. And I kind of did a little bit of an eye roll, you know, do we need another story on the Hawkeye Wave? But he teamed up with Brian Powers, one of our very fine photographers, and they told a video story as well as a text story through the eyes of a sick child receiving the wave. And it's just a very powerful video. If you haven't seen it, I encourage you to go on to DesMoinesRegister.com and take a look at it. Will, I'm sorry to say, just in the past week, Will suffered from a heart defect since his birth. He had had a heart transplant, but he died last week. So it makes the story all that much more tender. Finally, another new wrinkle to our business model, and that's events. Now, we've long done events like public forums, like the Mental Health Forum, free events that we see as part of our public service mission. But we've also started hosting some events that are revenue-generating events, you know, trying to find new ways to pay for our journalism. One of the ones I'm most proud of is our storytelling series. It's something that Brian helps out a lot with. And these are just nights of authentic storytelling. Coaches work with storytellers to prepare their stories. Jonathan Wilson participated in one last year and told just a wonderful, rich, powerful story about some of his journey. I'm happy to report we're now in our third season, and we've gone now to double headers because we've been selling out so often. Our first one is Tuesday night. The first show is sold out, and the second, both, okay, are now sold out. So this has been a very popular series. If you haven't been, I would certainly encourage you to come. All Iowa Sports Awards, that's become a marquee event that honors our high school athletes. Usually more than 1,000 athletes are honored at that event. And then we also last year brought an auto show back to the Des Moines market, and that will be in March will be our second auto show. I am very proud of our content. We hope our readers find it useful, find it compelling, find it provocative. And that's whether you're reading, you know, picking up a newspaper on the desktop from your doorstep in the morning, or looking at it over the noon hour, sneaking in a peek while you're at work, or just reading it from your phone. We don't sort of care where those eyeballs are coming from as long as you're reading our content. That's pretty much the end of my prepared remarks. I wanted to allow some time for questions. I will talk about fake news if you want. I wanted mostly to focus on Iowa and the Register this morning, but I'll take all comments and questions. I'll even issue a public mea culpa, even to start this, about recent subscriber service meltdowns. We've had some difficulty on that front. In dealing, helping customers work through some fairly steep price increases. So if you want to talk about that, I'll answer questions on it, or catch you after to talk about any particular problems. But open for questions.
As I think about it, a lot of what I'm thinking in terms of comments and questions would be more appropriate for the publisher than for the editor. But from an editorial perspective, I'm a person who still mourns the loss of the Des Moines Tribune. The Tribune was the local newspaper. And this is inherent in the nature of print media in terms of when you've got to put the morning paper to bed and get it out and everything else. The Trib could pick up what happened during the night, during the day, and the advantage of the newspaper over the TV and radio is that you have the luxury of going into it in more depth. What I do not see in the Register or in any of the TV stations is good local coverage. I want the old police blotter, basically. What's going on in Des Moines that might affect me? What happened up the street on the other side of town? Short of a murder, a homicide, or a major robbery, or a police chase. And that's where I think there is a huge deficiency in the newspaper and in all the rest of the local newspaper.
That's certainly true, that there, as when your news staff is cut in half, basically, is that you make hard decisions about coverage. And right at the time I started in 2004, we were probably about a year into a big push on community coverage. We call them community registers. So there were three different registers that you get twice a week. Actually, I think they started three times a week, specific sections that would have things like police blotter, a lot more in-depth coverage of like high school coverage and that sort of thing. What we found over the years is that, you know, at first those were pretty fat with advertising, and they became thinner and thinner and thinner. You know, the as you go into kind of hyper local markets, you know, down to, you know, parts of neighborhoods almost, trying to deliver that kind of news, the audience of course is a lot smaller. As we've really had to make tough decisions about what are we going to cover, there is a whole level of local news that we just don't cover anymore. And as a purist, in many ways, journalist, I mourn that. Brian would tell you, looking at the stats a lot of that had I'm going to cite digital stats, and you're talking about print, but there's a lot of overlap as far as what people actually read. We have something called the e-edition, which is basically a reproduction of our print edition online, and they've done studies of that, and what people read in that print edition mirrors fairly closely what people read online, and those individual community items literally would have single digits numbers of people that would look at them. It became not a sustainable part of the business model, I'm sorry to say. Someone was asking me about this about a month ago. I did appeared with Kevin Cooney's panel on something he's doing now in his retirement called Wonks. It's kind of a live broadcast involving people talking about the political scene. He's doing it monthly and then turning it into a podcast. And someone in the audience asked a similar question about the news not being covered. And I said that you know, say if you covered, and I was just looking at stats on this, on an average weekday, we produce a little over 50 pieces of content. Now that may be a video, it may be a photo gallery, but most of that is stories. I venture to guess 10 years ago, that number might have been 100 stories. So certainly there are things that we no longer can get to. My job is trying to, and all of our jobs, is trying to choose that right 50 stories that we're gonna do and make sure that they're the quality that you've all come to expect from the Register staff.
Can you pontificate on your relationship with Google and Facebook? I mean, they have a duopoly on online ad revenue.
This is one where I'll certainly maybe ask Brian to jump in because that's his specialty, social media. It's almost kind of this love-hate tense relationship because Facebook brings a lot of our audience to our work, so it's very much an important part of our business model. But Facebook can decide to change an algorithm and all of a sudden 20% of your traffic goes away. I don't believe that the big thinkers of the world have given enough thought, and it'll probably be decades into the future where academics will look back and think, my goodness, Facebook ran the world. It's recent change in saying that it's going to kind of try to go back to its roots and give more sort of credit in what it surfaces to relationships between friends and family, and really not surface as much work from publishers, is going to give us lots of credit, headaches, at trying to figure out how we still keep attracting audience to our work. I don't think of Facebook as the evil empire, but especially what's come out about, the clearly attempt by some people to manipulate the election, and I think a lack of transparency about the ads that were bought in that attempt, to me that's a very serious question for the functioning of our democracy. So, It's a tense relationship. Brian, do you want to?
I think that sums it up well. I always describe it as, the news feed is Facebook's sandbox and they let us come play and we have to kind of work by their rules and they can change them whenever they want. And some days it works out really well for us and we have a good time, and others it doesn't.
What do you want to see change? Do you want new rules put in place, more transparency in the ad eyes, or what? Or do you want to slice the pie? If someone clicks on the article, you get paid.
We'll certainly always take a slice of the pie.
Yeah.
I think, particularly when it comes to political advertising, that the any transparency matters that policies that you apply to the rest of the media need to apply to Facebook. And our editorial board certainly long stood for more transparency overall in political advertising. We have long editorialized against Citizens United. We think that all of this dark money where you don't know where it comes from that's influencing politics, I think that's a cancer on the system. And I actually, our editorial position has been that we don't care if billionaires flood the market with money as long as people know where it's coming from. We're First Amendment advocates. We want there to be full transparency.
On a lighter note, my brother and I, as children, love to stare down at the printed presses in the downtown building as kids. Are they still there, or what's happened to them?
They're no longer there. In fact, there's a bar there, basically. And renovated
in that
into
same
apartment.
Space down below.
Our production facilities down south of Floor, south of the airport. But yeah, I miss that. I don't know if how many of you have been able to go see the Post movie, but one little detail of that just flooded me with memories, and that was the reporter. It was Ben Dickey, and you know, had the press had started up, and he was back at his desk, and you could feel the rumble of the press. Any newspaper that I ever worked in that had a press on set, you could always hear and feel the start of the press, and that was also always a kind of fun part of the day.
Carol, thank you very much.
It has become a tradition that we give a small token of appreciation to our speakers. This is a recording of the Des Moines Gay Men's Chorus, which we hope you will enjoy. Thank you very much. It seems to me that you are in a leadership position in the enemy of the people that is doing a great service for the people. And we appreciate that. It seemed to me as I was listening to your presentation of all that the Register has done that it might be worthwhile to have a regular feature titled What the Register Has Done for You Lately and highlight some of these things and then give the access instructions. If you want to go back and read that article, it might be a very worthwhile thing to keep some of those stories in the public's mind. And on the whole issue of fake news, it seems to me it would be well to get that term defined. There can always be mistakes made in reporting on the facts of current events. The difference between a fake news source and a genuine news source is a genuine news source will, when a mistake is found, go back, apologize for it, and publish a correction. Something that we have not generally been seeing from those who continue to use that terminology. Evidence the number of people at the inauguration as an example. Okay, thank you very much again, Carol, for being here. And thank all of you for being here, and I hope that you will be here again on March the 2nd for our next meeting. Our speaker is going to be Ann Seltzer of the Seltzer Group. That's a polling firm that in fact does the polling for the Des Moines Register and a number of others, and it should be fascinating to hear from her and get figured out why we do the things we do and how it is that they can count it and how do they know they're only off by 3%. Why don't they just adjust for that and give us an accurate number? Ms. Seltzer should be here and be able to answer some of those probing questions. Future speakers, in April on the 6th, we will have the Des Moines Police Department's Sergeant Paul Parizek, a former student of Steve Persons, who is the frequent spokesperson for the police department after some horrific thing has happened here locally. On May the 4th, Keith Snow, who is the CEO of E2B. It's a data mining firm that can, with about two pieces of information about you, also tell anyone who wants to know what kind of dog food you buy. It's going to be a fascinating piece to hear from him. So we will look forward to those speakers, and I will look forward to seeing all of you in March. Thanks for being here today.